You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Monday. Joining me from the East Coast of the United States is John Stevens. And first of all, John, good morning. Thanks for coming on All Marine Radio.
Yeah, good morning, Mac. Glad to be here.
All right. First of all, we need to find out about you before we talk about your book and Ribbon Creek in general. So tell us about yourself. You were born and raised where?
I was born and raised in a small town in central Massachusetts, and spent my early years until I went off to college there.
So you're born, what, 1940?
Late 1939.
And so how does the Marine Corps get on your radar? I would imagine growing up as a young man or a boy and then a young man, the Marine Corps, World War II, post-World War II in Vietnam, you probably saw a lot of Marines, but how did it get on your specific radar as something that you wanted to do?
Well, I graduated from high school. I was 17 years old. I had already been accepted at a very fine college, but I just knew myself that I wasn't ready to go. I was too young, too immature. My dad had been a Marine during World War II.
Uh-oh.
Even though he didn't see combat, he was in Hawaii for much of his time during the war. But I knew that much from there. And so at the time, the Marine Corps was offering a program of 2 years active duty and 4 years reserved. And I thought this might be just the thing for me. I'd do 2 years in the military, and then I'd be 19, I'd get out, and I would probably be much better suited to go head off to college at that time.
That's a pretty mature decision. I don't know that I'd be capable of making something like that. You sound like a mature guy, even as a young man who says he wasn't mature enough to go to college.
Yeah, well, I probably didn't think of it quite in those terms, but I knew I wasn't ready.
You ship off to Paris Island, and now, just so everybody knows, and let me just tell you, the reason I wanted to do this is we see, as a Marine, as, you know, somebody who reads and, you know, the news or whatnot, we see Ribbon Creek, you know, referenced a lot. But I don't know too many of us that know really the details of what happened, the footnotes that should be read along with it, the institutional response, and kind of from soup to nuts about an incident that has cast such a long shadow. You know, if you put the monoliths of the Marine Corps, you know, someplace, Ribbon Creek's one of them. And it still impacts us, and it's still in the news today. And so I wanted to have you on, John, because I saw the book that you've written, and I read a couple reviews and what people enjoyed about them. That was all the interviewing that you did, and so that's why you're here this morning. But I want to talk about the rest of your career. So you get out of the Marine Corps, and then you ultimately are mature enough to go to college, right?
Yeah, well, I went to college, let's put it that way. And by the time I finished college, I was 23. I was married, had a child shortly thereafter. And then I worked days, and I went to law school nights. Finished up law school in 1969 and became a practicing lawyer after that.
So you become a practicing lawyer, and where do you do that? Do you do that in your hometown, or do you move someplace else?
Actually, at that time, I was living in a city called Newburyport, Massachusetts. Lived there for actually most of my adult life, and I practiced there for 25 years.
Where is that for those of us that are Massachusetts geography challenged?
If you looked at a map of Massachusetts, when on the east coast from Boston, you went 35 miles due north on the coast. It's right up on the Merrimack River between Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Sounds like a lovely place. On the coast? Not in a big city?
Yeah, I love it. It was. It was a wonderful little town.
So you did that. Just so you know, I don't like the entire state of Massachusetts. My dad managed the Red Sox in 1986 when the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs.
Yes. I don't know who you're talking about.
So less than fond memories of Boston, although it was a lovely place where we enjoyed it, but things didn't turn out well, and so I've held it against the entire state and anyone from there since. So I just want you to know that, John, before you come on.
Well, maybe I can prove to be the exception.
There you go. Well, there's a few of them, I will tell you that. So you were a practicing attorney, and then you become a judge. Tell me about that.
I was appointed by Governor Weld as a judge in 1996. My practice was a general practice. I did a fair amount of criminal work and divorce family law. But I was appointed to the family court in 1996 by Governor Weld, and I was a judge there for 10 years until I retired in 2006.
Tell me about family court. Things people don't know. What is the majority of your time spent doing in family court?
Majority of the time is dealing with people who are really come out of dysfunctional families by and large. When I took the position, I thought I would be dealing mostly with sort of middle class, fairly relatively civil divorce proceedings and the like. But it turned out that those were few and far between. Mostly it was a matter of collecting support from deadbeats, adjudicating paternity cases, dealing with guardianships and children that were in terrible conditions.
Would it surprise people to spend a week in a family court to see what goes on in their community?
I think they'd be shocked.
Really? Shocked?
Yeah, really. It's largely a no-win situation. You do the best you can to keep the lid on the pot, but, you know, the problems, most of the people that are coming before you, the problems are so substantial that no court, no priest, no teacher is really going to resolve the problem.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Yeah, because you see these things and you think, you know, what can we do as a nation, as a state, as a society, you know, in order to make things better? And is there anything we can do, or is it just, you know, is there some of us that struggle with life and you get married and then bad things come out of that and somebody's got to jump in the middle of it to separate the parties and to at least try to make sense of it? But is there anything more? Is there any more that we can do as a community to help?
Well, I mean, I think you do need to have courts. I know you do need to have courts and police, because otherwise people would be resolving their problems with baseball bats and the pickaxe. But the underlying problem, in my opinion, has to do with the disintegration of the family structure. And when you've got so many kids that are born and not tended to, and drug problems and absentee fathers, that's the central problem.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. And so now you live in South Carolina. Paris Island called you back. What happened?
Well, in a sense, yes. When I finished my book, and it was published in 1999, my wife and I actually had been looking for some places to retire in warmer climate, and we came to Beaufort outside of Paris Island for a book signing. It was a natural place where a book like that would be received. And we liked the community. It was a small community, and we vacationed here for a while and then decided to move here, and we've lived here since for the last 10 years.
Really? So what's the best part of retiring in South Carolina along the coast?
What's the best part of what?
Retiring along the coast of South Carolina.
Well, in this particular area, it's a nice mixed community, about 15,000 people around here. They have a lot of cultural activities. You've got the water. You've got a warm climate, too warm in, for a couple of months, but a warm climate year-round. And you've got all sorts of activities that are going on, particularly in Beaufort, in the community that we live in.
All right. The let's talk about your Marine Corps career a little bit. So you joined the Marine Corps in 1957, and and then you go into aviation. What? You must be a smart guy, obviously.
I went through Parris Island and then up through Camp Geiger for the basic infantry training.
Right.
And then I was my permanent duty station was a now defunct airbase called Marine Miami in Opa-locka, northwestern Florida. It was a World War II base, and it was closed out in 1958, and I was then shipped up to Cherry Point, where I finished out my time. I worked largely in a clerical capacity, working on flight plans and in conjunction with the control tower. No stellar activities in those days.
No, I mean, it all makes it work, right?
Yeah,
and so, so you do your 2 years, and then you did your stint in the reserve, and then that was you were done with the Marine Corps.
Then I was done. Yeah, I was honorably discharged in 1963.
All right. So, final question: kids along with all that practicing law.
Yeah, I had two children along with that, and of course I had the benefit in '63 of not only having a family, but my service obligation behind me when they started calling up Marines for Vietnam, so I didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, that was I don't know. We talk about things that we don't do right, and chief among them, is Vietnam with its 58,000 killed in action footnote and multiples of that wounded and sent back home.
God rest their souls.
Yeah, you know what? And again, and to a nation that didn't want them. And and still dealing with that issue. So and so, John, talk about after all these years, what made you write the book?
Well, what happened was after practicing as a divorce lawyer primarily for 20 years or so, I was feeling pretty burned out. I was in my late 40s. One summer, I went out and did some hiking with a friend out on a section of the Lewis and Clark Trail out in the Pacific Northwest. And while we were there, we bumped into a group from Washington State University, and a dream sort of hatched in my mind at the time that wouldn't it be nice to take a sabbatical and go back to university now, 25 years after I've graduated, and as a grad student. And so I did. And my wife, Pamela, and our son, who was 15, and the three of us drove cross-country, and we spent a year out in Pullman, Washington, as a grad student in studies at Washington State. And it was a wonderful year, really. We had a great time. Enough so that I thought I might change careers and get into teaching at the college level. But there were practical problems with doing that. I never could have afforded it, for one thing, and I was too old. And, at best, I would have maybe found something in a community college. So it just wasn't realistic. But while those plans were in the formative stages, I was thinking about what would be a good topic for a doctoral dissertation. And I thought about, that Ripon Creek story, I've never heard anybody really deal with it. Those guys are still alive, by and large. And I was an historian by vocation and interest. And, of course, as a lawyer, wouldn't that be a great tale to find out exactly what happened and write about it and write about the court-martial? So I changed plans. I never became a professor, but I sat on the notion of writing the book for a couple of years and finally lit enough of a fire under myself to get going with it, and I did.
Now, had you written anything before? You know, because writing's not the easiest endeavor. As somebody who's written a little bit and nothing approaching a book or anything like that, but just the craft of writing can be daunting, I imagine, though, as a lawyer. You did a fair amount of it. So talk to me about actually the craft of writing. How did you look at that?
Well, I had never written anything that had been published. I did have to do some writing as a lawyer, but that's kind of in a different context. And I had more detailed writing when I was as a grad student out in Washington and did well enough at it that I thought, you know, I could probably put this story together. And a couple of other things were in my mind at the time. I'd read the one that stands out. I read a biography of Henry Flagler, the great developer of Florida, written by a professor, and I thought, if this guy can get that published, I can write something at least as good as that. And having that experience, I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. And so I did.
Okay. All right. And so talk about you go about the craft of writing the book. What was the biggest thing you wanted to accomplish? And did you want to tell the story?
Yeah, what I really wanted to do was to tell a story. I heard, you know, the rumors, I've heard the tales, I've heard the drunken
right.
sergeant, I heard this, that, and the other thing. I didn't really know much about it. And I did remember that my DI, when I was down here a year after this happened, was talking about how the civilians railroaded the sergeant, and he was a decent guy, and it was a farce and a fiasco, what they did to him, and it wasn't right, and so forth, and so on. So I thought it would be an interesting topic, and to my knowledge, nobody had written about it, so I figured I'd give it a go.
Interesting. I think it's interesting from, you know, you as you kind of just your recollection of what you heard another drill instructor say, you know, and I don't know if you would expect them to say something else, but I mean that sticks in my head, you know, like if whoever said it was somebody that you respected, and then you hear him say, hey, he was a good guy, he got screwed, and yet six Marines died that
right.
night. How the hell would he get screwed if he was in charge of that? And I would imagine that would stick with you for a little bit.
It sure did. Yeah, it did. Or it sort of came back, I guess. It stuck with me in my subconscious, but when I started thinking about this whole topic, all of those comments came back.
Interesting. My guest this morning is John C. Stevens III. Now, John, that sounds like somebody who ought to be working in the State Department, I have to tell you. And with a relative of Thurston Howell's. So explain the third thing. Obviously, your family likes that name.
Yeah, it was a family name. My grandfather was the first. They were Philadelphia people, actually. My father moved to Massachusetts during the Depression to find work, and he did. He was the junior, and then when I came along, they wanted to perpetuate the family name, I guess, so I got that handle.
All right. So it wasn't a ticket to the State Department, obviously.
No, it wasn't a ticket to anything whatsoever.
Right.
We grew up in a little town with a very middle-class family.
All right. So let's talk about, we understand the reason you wrote the book. As you sat out to do research for the book, how did you, in terms of outlining how you would get information, how did you think that you would go about putting the book together?
Well, I just made a couple of blind calls. I called the drill instructor school at Parris Island to see if there was they had any information on that topic. And they put me in touch with a retired first sergeant. And he said, oh, yes, I've got all kinds of information on it. I'm glad to talk with you and so forth and so on. And so I took a trip down to Parris Island. I met with this guy, and it turned out he didn't have anywhere near as much as he was claiming he had, but he did know something about it, and he had an interest in the subject. And he had some contacts on Parris Island, too. So he and I together went to the Parris Island Museum. And by the way, I'll just put in a plug for that because I'm on the board of directors there. It's a wonderful museum. If anybody who's listening has an opportunity to be in the area, be sure to go to Parris Island and go to the museum. In any event, I went to the museum, and as luck would have it, they did have a copy of the platoon roster from this platoon 71, the one that where these young men who were from, who had drowned. So I had the names and addresses of the then addresses of all of the platoon members, and that was an invaluable starting point. And with that, I was able to contact, I think I got a hold of 28 or 29 out of them.
Wow, really?
For, you know, first-person interviews. Not all in person, some in person, and some on by telephone.
Right.
But
that's impressive, though, when you look at that many years to be able to track. Because, you know, a lot of people, they don't want to be, you know, they don't want anything to do with it. Some of them you can't find, you know, there's 80 names of this guy around the country, and none of them pans out. And so, that's impressive.
I'll tell you what, if I can interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
One of the things that had happened was the Marines blamed the recruits for what had happened, by and large. And these guys said, several of them reported that they'd gotten in fights and gotten beaten up on their later years in the Marine Corps.
Tell you this. I read a few things, and almost every one of them point to the recruits as a cause of it. And to include a couple things written by guys in the platoon that say that guys were in, you know, it's interesting, they use the terms of the day, guys were doping off, and they were, you know, I mean, I told a friend when over the weekend we were talking about this segment, and I said, yeah, I'm really excited. I said, I really don't know that much about Ribbon Creek, and we're going to discuss it on Monday. And they said, oh, yeah, you know, that dude took him. I said, yeah, but you know what? It's interesting because the stuff I've read said, now these are recruits, right?
Right.
He tells them, they're at the rifle range, he tells them not to go get seconds for chow, and they do it anyway.
Right.
And my friend says, what? I said, yeah. Then he tells them to do their laundry during the day, and he comes out around the corner, and in my mind, I see the two-story, you know, concrete barracks that, you know, are built around the Marine Corps. I see the concrete, the concrete pillars that we use for hanging your laundry, right? And
right.
I see
the wash rack,
right? And I see laundry being hung, Marines doing their laundry, and then I see some Marines laying on the grass sleeping, right?
Yeah.
And their recruits. Now, those two things happening in the same day in the Marine Corps, I know, and I wasn't in the Marine Corps in the 50s, that will get your ass in a lot of trouble.
Right.
And so, you know, I can imagine post-World War II, post-Korea, Marine Corps was a pretty rough, blunt, tough place. He was having none of it. So I read it, and I was like, he had every reason to take him out and thrash him. Now, it's interesting that you would bring that up, because that was my conclusion in the little that I read. Like, wow, I didn't know that. He should have been pissed at him.
Well, yeah, that's not entirely accurate. That's
okay.
Close to it, but it isn't entirely. The second son, Chow, was one fellow who was a platoon leader who went back, and McEwen said to him, what have you done to deserve seconds and get the hell back there? And the field day was ordered because he sent recruits out back to shine shoes, not necessarily to do laundry, but to shine their shoes and polish the brass on the belt buckles. And then some of them, lay down on the grass and were asleep. And that was brought to McEwen's attention by another DI, so he was embarrassed.
That's never a good, that's
yeah.
not a good thing.
He got some recruits out there crapped out, he said.
Crapped out.
Those must be your boys, McEwen. But so there was that. So there were some screw ups in the platoon. There's no question about it.
So one of the things that came out in the interviews was that over the course of years that they had paid for that. That it was their fault that happened. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah. That was a pretty constant theme all the way through.
So you have this series of interviews, and I guess which only begat more questions.
Yes, the interviews painted a fairly interesting picture, I thought, of McEwen, the DI, as a pretty decent guy. I wouldn't say the recruits blamed themselves, but they all, with one exception, spoke fairly highly of him as a person, as a decent guy, which was kind of, I was surprised to hear that. Yeah. The other piece of information that was invaluable to me, aside from the recruit roster, was I got a copy of the transcript of the court-martial. So I had all the testimony of everybody to work from and to distill and analyze. And that was a real useful tool too, as well.
Interesting. All right. John, we have to take a break. And then when we come back, what I'd like to do is I'd like for you to start with, can you describe Parris Island for us back in the day? Recruit training back then, just a little I've read about it, a little bit different than it is today.
Yes.
And so if you, we could start with, you could kind of lay out Parris Island and then how recruit training ran and we'll kind of create the situation. Then I'd like to talk about, his first name is Matthew, right? Matthew McEwen.
Yes, Matt McEwen.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about him and who he was and how he arrives there, and then if we have time today, and we may not, we'll kind of get into the incident itself, and then ultimately want to go how the Marine Corps responded to it, and ultimately the lessons learned and how it impacted the institution. So it might take us a couple visits to do all of that, but I can't tell you again. Thank you very much for coming on and doing this, I've already learned a ton. But I think it's really it's interesting that the other thing I want to talk to you about is and we'll do this right at the start after the break is the movie The DI comes out.
Yes.
And again, it's a movie, right?
Yeah.
Designed to make money, and so. Not exactly always, doesn't always need to be, accurate. And so I want to ask you about that as well. So, anyway.
Okay.
A lot of stuff, as you can see, Ribbon Creek, pretty pregnant subject here.
Sure is.
To this day, after all these years.
Well, of course, there are things going on over Parris Island today, as I'm sure you know about.
Absolutely.
That sort of raises some questions about the historical, piece too. You gonna call me back, or
no,
shall I stay
If you just stay on the line, it'll be about three and a half minutes, and then we'll resume if that's all right.
Sounds good.
All right, we continue with John C. Stevens III, and he's a normal human being in spite of that lofty name he's got. And his book is entitled "Court Martial at Parris Island: The Ribbon Creek Incident," and it's on Amazon if you want to get a hold of a copy. And we'll continue with him right after this. On a Monday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave service women. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue on a Monday. We're talking about Ribbon Creek. My guest is John Stevens, and he's written a book. He's a former Marine, and the book is entitled Court Martial at Parris Island, the Ribbon Creek Incident. You know, when I say he's a former Marine, you know, John, I have everybody like, oh, there's no such thing as a former Marine. Well, what the hell do I introduce him as then? Hey, Marine. I'm like, that's too wordy, okay. So anyway, I know there's no former Marines, but you and I both have the two of them. Anyway, sure. As we continue, talk about the effect that the movie The DI has on just the whole topic of Ribbon Creek.
Well, Jack Webb produced the movie The DI, and interestingly enough, it came out just at the time of the McEwen court-martial in 1956. It was being produced then. It came out in 1957. But there wasn't apparently a Hollywood outfit that was looking to make a movie about Ribbon Creek, and of course the Marine Corps was not interested in cooperating in that endeavor whatsoever. Right. But Jack Webb was a veteran. He was in, I think it was Army Air Corps, and a very patriotic American. He wanted to make a movie that showed what recruit training was really like, and he was going to build it around a story called Death of a Sand Flicker, which is kind of a humorous tale that was written by a former Marine about the burial of the killing and the burial of a sand flea by recruits. Those of you who have been through Parris Island know that the sand fleas were held in a sacred position. You couldn't kill him, and you couldn't do anything to him, and some recruit did. Anyway, that was kind of the part of the story. But what Webb did was he really portrayed the Marine Corps, not in a fictional way, but really recruit training essentially as it was, with a very stern but well-meaning and highly professional drill instructor. Webb played the primary role
right.
of a tech sergeant there. And going through, he's got a malingering recruit, and he brings him around finally to turn out to be a good recruit and graduate. It's a little bit of a campy story, but it's really is well done in the sense of portraying what recruit training was like at the time. And it was a great lift, I think, for the Marine Corps to have that tale out there and in the movie houses where they could see that the Marines and the DIs weren't a bunch of sadists and killers, but rather very hard working professionals trying to do a tough job of molding these young civilians into Marines, basic Marines.
Does the movie help or hurt the Marine Corps? Does it help or hurt McKeon?
Well, I think it certainly couldn't hurt him because the central character that Webb plays as a tech sergeant, as a Marine about the same age as McKeown, is a very likable and professional, well-regarded, well-respected guy doing his job well. So I don't know how it could hurt McKeown. They don't make any contrast within the movie to what McKeown did and what Webb did. You just see the drill instructor, his job, and how well he does it.
I've got an email for you, John. Mac, interesting stuff as always. Thank you very much for doing this. I don't know that much about Ribbon Creek, and I've already learned a ton, much as you said that you have. Question. In other discussions relative to Paris Island, one of the things that's come up that's interested me repeatedly has been the assignment of staff NCOs and NCOs to the depots in their first tour after their combat tours. It does not sound to me like it's a good policy because of the anger that most of us have upon leaving combat and the fact that we haven't dealt with that yet. Does Mr. Stevens think that Mr. McKeown's World War II service, and then in parentheses he writes, I don't know what it was, or his service in Korea impacted him at Paris Island? So let's talk about Matt McKeon first, and then we'll set kind of the scene up for Paris Island at the time. Tell us about Matt McKeon. Who was he?
It's pronounced McKeown, by the way, but it looks
McKeown.
Like McKeon. Yeah, sorry, but that's how they pronounced it.
No, they say it. I've learned already, Lejeune. It's not the way it's written, but it's the way the family pronounces it, so get your shit together.
That's right.
Camp Lejeune, I'm with it.
Matt McKeown grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Ah.
It was a large Irish family. He went to parochial school, and he joined the Navy in World War II. He was on the carrier, I think it was the Essex, but he was on a carrier for a while in action. He got out of the military after the war. He had a civilian factory-type job. Wasn't happy with it. And in 1948, he joined the Marine Corps, went through Paris Island himself. At that time, there was a farm here. He claimed that he was ordered to lie down or take cover in out on the pig manure on the farm and had gone through that sort of stuff, which he claimed was fairly routine at the time.
Right.
Anyway, he finished up Paris Island, and he wound up in Korea. As a machine gunner over there. So he had quite an illustrious career. He came back, was married, had a couple of kids, and I have never heard any, in reference to your caller's question, I've never heard any reference to or any evidence that McKeown in any way suffered from PTSD or any other combat-related disabilities or impediments.
All right.
Didn't appear to be. He was a friendly, gregarious type of person. And he went to the DI school, signed to the DI school in late 1955. He was then a staff sergeant. He finished in the top half of his class there, did reasonably well, and Platoon 71, which was the one from which these recruits were marched into the Marsh, was his first platoon. He was not the senior DI, of course, of that platoon. But anyway, that's him up to that time. Now, do you want me to talk about him as a man later in life when I was doing the work, or just stay with the back in the time?
Let's just stay with the time.
Okay.
Just so everybody knows, how many times did you get a chance to speak with him? Because I think that's one of the great pieces of your work.
With McEwen himself?
Yes.
I spoke with him in person doing the research on two occasions. And then I spoke with him after that on a couple of occasions, after the book came out.
Was he happy to cooperate and tell his piece of the story?
Here's how it went. When I was doing the research, I knew I'd have to try and get in touch with McEwen. He was certainly the central figure in all of this drama. And I knew from rumor, I guess, that he was still alive. And he came from Worcester. Well, I found his name in the phone book. He wound up living in a town called West Boylston, which is outside of Worcester, central
mm-hmm.
Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote his phone number down beside his name, and I think I nervously carried it around in my pocket for two or three days, trying to summon enough courage to give him a call, because I knew this isn't something he's going to be happy to talk about.
Right.
And
oh, by the way, I don't want to say it's make or break it, but it's a huge piece of your research, right? If he says, no, I'd rather not cooperate, it's certainly not the same piece of work.
Yeah, that's right. It would have come out very differently.
Right.
So anyway, I called him up, and he answered the phone. And I said, is this Matthew McEwen? He said, yes. And I said, well, my name's John Stevens, and I'm writing about Ribbon Creek. And he went, oh, I heard this noise. And I said, but, you know, I'm a former Marine. There's your former Marine. But I said, I'm a former Marine, and I would really like to talk with you about it. He said, it's not one of the kind of things I like to talk about. He said, but you said you were a Marine? I said, yes. He said, all right, I'll talk with you. So we did. And we spent the better part of 2 days talking. Well, he was totally forthright and candid and as contrite as anyone I've ever seen. I mean, this brought it all back for him. And he went through it with tears on his cheeks. Told me about his version of what happened.
Wow. Okay. Now let's talk about Paris Island back in the day. We'll begin to tie these separate themes together. Tell me about Paris Island and the way recruit training was run. First of all, I've read that there was no officers other than a company commander in the company. Could you tell us, you know, the structure of recruit training and the status of the POI? Was it as structured as it is today? What was recruit training like in 1956 when this happened?
Well, I tell you as best I can.
Okay.
I don't know if there were other officers there, but I do know that it was clear from in the aftermath and the after action reports and all that there was a lack of proper officer supervision, and the Marine Corps acknowledged that. That was one of the basic changes they made afterwards. So there were whatever officer material there was, wasn't adequate. The DI was king. The DI did basically whatever he wanted to do. I could go on at great length about what was going on at that time, but I thought I would, if you'll allow me, I'll read about two or three sentences of what General Wallace Greene, who took over Paris Island after this and later became Commandant of the Marine Corps.
Sure.
What Wallace Greene said. He said, and this is in a letter to Dr. Eugene Alvarez. Gene Alvarez was very helpful to me, and he's written several books about Paris Island, including a recent history that just came out a couple of months ago. General Green wrote to Alvarez, and Alvarez was kind enough to send me a copy of the letter. And here's what Green says. He says that when he assumed command in May of 1956, now this is a month after the recruits were drowned,
mm-hmm.
quote, 10 recruits were in the hospital with broken noses, broken by the fists of DIs, close quote. And then he went on to say that, quote, most of the old-time officers devoted their energies and time to golf, fishing, drinking, and womanizing, leaving training up principally to NCOs, close quote. That's about as succinct a statement as I could come up with about what it was like there.
Wow.
I think the DIs ran the show, and most of them were pretty devoted guys, but, you know, with any group and with the pressures they were under, there were some who weren't. And I don't think McEwen was, a bad apple, frankly. But I do think that he did not, I think he exercised very poor judgment in a context in which what taking recruits into the waters around Parris Island was not an unheard of thing at that time.
Right. But so the picture you paint is one of a, you know, drill instructor driven world, and he's a new one, so he would be a junior,
right.
And it's on the weekend, so probably the senior is not around. And,
that's right.
And all right, so you can see the elements beginning to form. How many weeks was recruit training at this time?
At those days?
Yes.
I believe it was 12 weeks.
12 weeks. Okay.
Yeah.
And so recruit training's 12 weeks. What else about the training and at least the structure I read someplace that that, you know, it was a closed base and that there was no parade at the time and all of those were things that that happened after Ribbon Creek. So you pretty much you reported Parris Island and you went through recruit training, and if you made it you were assigned to schools and then ultimately the operating forces. If you didn't make it you went home and that was it, Parris Island.
Yeah, that was it a year and a half later when I went through recruit training. We had a final march out on the main drill field there, and if there were 50 people in attendance, I'd be surprised. And today, you know, it's 4,000 or 5,000 out there, all the families and everything.
That's a huge event. The we talked about Matt McEwen and just the island itself. Talk about the platoon members now, and let's talk a little bit about that night. Or about them as a group. And it seems like, and again, being an Irish Catholic, McEwen sounds like a, you know, he's a veteran of both World War II and Korea.
Right.
He wanted to join the Marine Corps and at a pretty advanced age goes through recruit training and now he goes through DI school. He does pretty decent, finishing in the upper half. And now he's on with his first platoon. One of the things that I've learned, I never worked at the drill field, but I had no idea how the hours that those guys put in, you know, while they're, you know, when they have a series. You know, essentially, you know, if they're lights on, the lights off, that's, you know, in before 5 in the morning and then done at 2200 at night. Those are long, long, long days. Talk to us about, at that time, was it pretty much the same? Where did those guys live that were, whether you were married or single, where did you live there?
Yeah, I think it was the DIs were putting in even more time than they are now, and they certainly are. They put in loads of time now.
Right.
They were. McEwen had a home. He had a wife and children. But when he on duty, he lived right there with the recruits in the barracks. And at that time, when all of this happened, they were out at the rifle range and. The barracks that they were in was right there. I had a chance to go through it before they demolished it. And I could see where he was. He was right there just off where all the recruits were bunked out. So what was your next question?
So did he live? I mean, he was married. Was his family down there? Did he live?
Yeah, he was married. His family was there. He had two kids and a third on the way, I think, at the time. And he had a little home off the depot. I'm sure it was pretty Spartan because right. Those guys didn't get paid much of anything,
right.
even though he was a staff sergeant.
And then how about the single drill instructor? Where did they live?
The single guys lived in enlisted housing themselves. There were two other DIs with that platoon 71. The senior guy was named Huff, and he was a staff sergeant too. I don't know much about him. I assume he had a family. But the junior guy was King. He was a buck sergeant. And he was, they call him a Hollywood Marine, but I assume that's because he went through San Diego, but, but he was, very young and immature, and knew at it too. So McEwen really was a guy, he was a little older, but he was in the middle. He had King on one hand, who was not someone who had any judgment you could turn to or any experience really. And Huff, who according to the recruits, had basically washed his hands at the platoon and didn't want much more to do with them. And McEwen was carrying the ball, I think, in large part, on his own. And that was what he was dealing with. And on that weekend, he had the duty. King was around because he probably had nothing else to do. He came over and shot the breeze with McEwen for a period of time. But Huff was nowhere to be found. And, so that was the situation on that Sunday.
Okay, so on that Sunday, so what week are they? They're at the rifle range, yes?
At the rifle range, they're about halfway through their training. They started in late February, and this is now April 8th.
Okay, and let's talk about the let me ask you about the you just read a few sentences from what General Green wrote. About the level of hazing, and that was just the way the Marine Corps was. The Marine Corps was a tough, fighting, drinking place. I mean, it was still that way when I joined in 1983. It was, you know, and I can remember vividly when I can't remember who it must have been General PX Kelly that put out. I don't know if it was an Almar that talked about drinking. And that no longer will, when MPs at the gate started riding people up, instead of giving them rides home, when you showed up drunk at the gate, people were indignant about it and that this was going to cost you your career. Like, what the hell is going on with our Marine Corps? Because this is not what we join. This has always been a drinking, fighting organization and a womanizing organization. Hell, it's the reason, half of us joined. We love that stuff. And and it was a place that we could do it. It was a guy's world. So talk to me about the hazing. When you talk to recruits, what did they say? Was that a part of what McEwen did? Was physical violence a part of it? What were their days like in terms of when they screwed up?
They didn't speak of being, physically abused by anybody in that platoon so much at that time. But let me give you an example on that of the way things were done, and I think this was probably pretty routine, certainly with McEwen. And he was not a sadist at all. I'm convinced that he actually was very devoted to these guys, and most of them were to him, as I mentioned. But after the afternoon, when some of these guys were screwing up, they were talking about falling asleep out in by the wash racks, and one guy goes back for seconds and so forth. McEwen called a couple of the leaders in, and he slaps them. He just slapped them. He said, "What the hell do you think you're doing? Like this. You're the big guy. You're supposed to be the leaders." He said, "Why don't we have a fight? Why don't you take a poke at me?" And of course, they declined to do that. Then he sat down with them and he said to two or three of these guys, you know, you're the leaders. You're the people they're looking up to. And yours starts growing up, they're going to do it too. One of the fellows, in fact, one of the guys who drowned, a recruit named Norman Wood, who was a big fellow, and he was black. And McEwen sat down with him, and he said, you know, the black recruits look up to you. And why aren't you a leader? You should be leading these guys, too. And he spoke to him like a man, you know.
Right.
And it said, what a tear came down his cheek as McEwen spoke to him that way. Probably wasn't used to being spoken to in that fashion.
Right.
And so, you know, a little rough stuff and wasn't out of the... It was common, I think. McEwen testified at the trial that he slapped a couple of recruits. He said, hell, I slapped my own kids harder than I slapped those recruits. That was a way of life. But I didn't hear about or read about with that platoon any really heavy-duty physical abuse.
Okay. All right.
When I was there a year... things had changed, of course. When I was there, I saw a recruit get taken down to the floor with the DI's hands around his throat, choking him till he turned almost blue. And I got punched myself once in the gut. And you know, a little bit of that physical stuff was still going on, even though it wasn't supposed to.
Well, it's not like it's ever left the Marine Corps. I mean, I experienced the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
Guys get stuffed in wall lockers. Guys get punched in the stomach. Somebody getting ready to walk out the door to an inspection with nose hair, and staff sergeant pulls out this Bic lighter and he says, "When I flick my Bic, you snort." And right, I mean, we laughed about it. I mean, at officer candidate school, the sergeant instructors, so the equivalent of the drill instructors, showing up late at night drunk, crawling under the building and yelling people's names, come under and see me. And this guy was a wrestler by the name of Lynch. I think he was 5'4". And he wanted a friend of mine, you know, all the MCs, right? All the Macs. His name was Brian McNamee. He's a wrestler from Delaware. And those guys, you know, see each other and they see the builds that they have and they immediately identify each other. So he comes back drunk at like 1 or 2 in the morning. McNamee says, I'm not going underneath the building to fight him. And like, don't get out of your rack, man.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's been part of the Marine Corps. And, so it's interesting. I mean, even the story about, you know, everybody's aghast, like somebody got stuck in a dryer. Well, that's been going on for years.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Stuck in most of the time everybody laughed about it. Cause it was a way to screw with somebody and everybody thought it was hilarious because who the hell would put another person in a dryer? And then started. But it was all part of the, call it hazing, call it discipline, call it the rite of passage of becoming a Marine. And not all of it was by the book. Interesting. All right, John, we've got to take another break for about another 3.5 minutes. And then when we come back, I want to talk about that day and then ultimately that night, at Ribbon Creek. So my guest this morning, John Stevens, he's the author of a book entitled, The Court Martial at Parris Island, the Ribbon Creek Incident. And again, John, thank you. I mean, I never knew anywhere close to the amount of detail, especially about McEwen. You know, if you would ask me, like, what do you know about him? Like, drunk, abusive, and, you know, got 6 guys killed. That's what I would have told you.
Before we finish, at some point, I'd like to talk about McEwen, the drunk, and liquor, because I think that's a very interesting topic.
Okay. All right. Why don't we start with that when we come back? We'll finish setting the table, and then we'll talk about the incidents of the day and then what happened that night.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
We are we're talking about the Ribbon Creek here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. More of that coming up next, right after this break. Don't go away.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
General Sergeant Arlie Ermey here with important information for veterans. At 2,600 American job centers nationwide, veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Eight 36 Pacific time on a Monday. Big debate tonight. Yeah, the whole nation, not the whole nation, but much of the nation riveted on that. And we continue, though. We're talking about, in light of what's going on at Parris Island, you see the Ribbon Creek incident mentioned a lot. And most of us don't know a whole lot about it. So a gentleman who wrote the book, former Marine, making us smart about the incident at Ribbon Creek. The book is entitled Court Martial at Parris Island, The Ribbon Creek Incident. You can find it on Amazon.com, and I would encourage you to make it part of your library. John Stevens. John, let's talk about liquor. Because again, the I would tell you, if you asked me, I would say, yeah, you know, he was drunk. So talk about, can you talk about liquor in the Marine Corps at the time and among drill instructors? Was, you know, his drinking and how it affected his job, if it did?
You know, I don't know how much I can talk about the drinking in the Marine Corps in 1956, because I don't have that much knowledge of it, but I can mention a few things.
Sure.
I think it was, liquor was a big part of the macho Marine persona that you alluded to earlier. This is part of being a Marine, is can you hold your liquor, how much can you drink, and blah, 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 and all that went with it. At Parris Island in 1956, there was an officers' club where they served liquor and other things. There was a staff enlisted club where they served liquor. There was an enlisted man's club where they served liquor. Today, there are none of those things. There is a restaurant type facility called Traditions, and there is a section of it where there's a bar there, but it's not like a hangout for anybody.
Right.
Gone is the enlisted men's club, gone is the staff enlisted club, and so forth. So, you know, liquor was a big part of things, a way of life and who you were as a Marine, I think.
You know, John, one of the things I think is interesting, I mean, the mission of All Marine Radio is post-combat related mental health. So we talk about our culture all the time. And you know, so much, I mean, now, you know, you talk to Vietnam veterans, they say, you know, it wasn't a diagnosis. We didn't know what was wrong with us. Carl Marlanis, who won the Navy Cross, in Vietnam and wrote, has written a couple good books. One is Matterhorn. The other one is called What It's Like to Go to War. When he was on, he said, I didn't think it was my combat experience. My second wife said that they were doing, anger management counseling as part of something for my work, and that maybe I should go through it. And he said that was the first time somebody, he said, the guy looks at me and says, did you ever serve in the military? And he said, yeah. And he said, what did you do? He said, I was a infantry officer in Vietnam, in the Marine Corps. And he said, did you go to Vietnam? And he said, I did. And he said, that's it. And he said, what do you mean? He said, you haven't dealt with your Vietnam stuff, have you? And he said, with that, he said, I started crying. And he said, my wife had to come get me. And he said, I couldn't believe it. And Marlanis is a big dude. This is a guy who's fought in World War II. He's fought in Korea. He's a machine gunner in Korea. So normally those guys were pretty busy guys. How do they deal with life as they, you know, not only the people they killed don't tend to be too much of an issue, but, you know, their friends and the different things you see relative to innocent people, little kids who were killed, that stuff never leaves you. And so I just find it interesting that liquor is a big part of the Marine Corps, and I think for a good reason, because, you know, guys got to deal with stuff, and a lot of times that's how they deal with it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Talk about him. Is McCune, is he a big drinker?
I don't think he was. I don't think he was a big drinker in the sense of, well, I'll give you an example. If you would like me to, I
sure.
can sort of run you through the background on the liquor on that day.
Yeah.
That might shed some light on the question you just raised. McCune had the duty on that Sunday, and in the morning, late morning, around 11 o'clock or so, a range staff sergeant who was one of the range instructors came over to him and said, you know, hey, I've had a bad night, and I got some hooch in my car. Let's go over and get it. I need it because I need a drink. This guy, his name was Scarborough, he was the one that suggested this, and he was, you know, I hate to say it because I don't have enough data to back it up, but right. It sounds to me like, you know, he was a heavy drinker, let's put it that way.
Okay.
So Scarborough goes over and gets his bottle of vodka. It's about half full. I think it was a fifth. We don't even sell them in fifths anymore, but it was a fifth, a little under a quart. It's about half full. And he invites McEwen to have a drink with him, and McEwen accepts. And King, the junior DI, comes in, and he has a drink. And McEwen bought a Coke and poured some vodka into it. Now, the question is, who had how many drinks there? Scarborough, we know, had two or three anyway out of that bottle, and King had at least one. And McEwen, the testimony of King, I think it was, but somebody was that McEwen had a couple of drinks, and McEwen testified, well, I think I had two or three drinks from the bottle. And that's it. And that's when the DI comes in and says, hey, those your guys crapped out in the back there, and so that puts an end to that socialization that's going on. McEwen brings his platoon in, and he's very upset about this, and he tells them, we're going to have a field day, you know, going to scrub the barracks down, and he has them do that. And later in the afternoon, a couple hours later, he goes over to get the recruit mail. King's there, so King says, I'll watch the platoon while you go. And he goes over to get the mail, and he gives somebody a ride over, as I recall it was, and somehow or another they go into the staff MCO club, and somebody buys McEwen a beer. And McEwen takes a couple of sips, and some fellow says to a colleague, says, come on out and see, I want to show you my new car. McEwen goes out, looks at the car, he goes back in, the beer's gone, the bartender's cleaned it up. McEwen takes the mail, and he goes back. And then he sleeps for 2 or 3 hours. He had a bad leg. He had a lot of sciatic problems, maybe a slip disc, I don't know.
Okay.
And he was walking with a squeegee handle as a crutch, or as a cane, sort of, to help him walk. So he's in some degree of discomfort. And then at night, after the recruit goes back for seconds, that's when he calls in the various recruits in there. And with one of them, he takes the vodka bottle, it's still there, and he takes and he lifts it up to his lips, and he said, now, would you like to have a drink? And the recruit says something like, well, I don't know, sir. And he said, well, when you get to be a man, you get out of here, you can have a drink then. And he puts it down. McEwen says he didn't, that the bottle was capped. And the recruit says, I'm not sure whether it was capped or not, but at the most he took a swig out of it.
Right.
And that, that was the evidence, the total evidence of drinking. Probably at the most three drinks around midday, a couple of sips of beer mid-afternoon, and maybe a swig at 7:30 at night. And they go into the drink at about, it was a little before 9 o'clock. He marches them down and takes in. And he went in himself, too, by the way. He led them into Ribbon Creek. He was in front, and he was giving instructions about, you know, stay close to the bank because the moonlight can, if you're out near the middle of the stream, the enemy can see you more easily or something like that. And then the panic breaks out, and all hell breaks loose.
Let me talk to you about so the picture of drinking, which is interesting, is these guys are on duty. So so drinking on duty is not something out of the ordinary. They do it in public. They do it in a duty hut. They do it they do it in front of the recruits. So drinking at this day and age is not something they hide, or they're not something that they seemed overly concerned about.
Not so much so. Of course, recruits, unless they were called in later on, wouldn't have seen King and Scarborough and McEwen taking two or three drinks in there. That was in the DI's room. But, I mean, drinking in the barracks is certainly not an absolute no-no at the time. It was against regulations, and there was no argument that they had been drinking in the barracks. But it doesn't seem like it was something so extraordinary. But the question of intoxication was the one that I was interested in, and trying to get to the bottom of that. And some of the recruits said, well, he looked a little unsteady on his feet when he was going to march us out there. And others said he was fine, didn't seem anything unusual about him. So I tried to get at it from two angles. One was, how much was in the bottle when they started and how much was in the bottle when they finished. And so how much was consumed and what's the likelihood that whatever it was would have caused intoxication, and what was the time lag. And my estimate, and these are estimations, of course, right. If you start with a bottle half full, and the testimony was there were about 2 inches left in it when they took it at the time they arrested McEwen, that probably about 8 to 10 ounces had been consumed. And we know that Scarborough had 2 or 3 drinks and King had 1. So it seems to me McEwen at the most had maybe 5 ounces of vodka 8 or 9 hours before he goes into the drink, and maybe another drink at 7 o'clock. I don't think on that basis that there's any strong evidence that he was drunk, and even questionable whether he was in any way under the influence of alcohol. He said he certainly was not, but, you know, that's his version. You'd expect him to say that. The other thing was that there was a Navy doctor who examined him and had written down that he was, gave him a number of sobriety tests,
right.
And they did a blood test on him. And the sobriety tests, he was fine. And did all of them, passed all of them, and on the blood test, they called it a Bogan's test, which I believe is the blood test. The doctor on cross-examination at the court-martial, he had put down possibly under influence, although not clinically so, or something like that. And the McEwen's lawyer, Berman, who was a great lawyer,
right.
Cross-examined him, and the doctor changed his mind. He said there was no evidence of intoxication. Now, this is an hour after they come out of the water, but I don't, personally, on the evidence that I saw, I don't think I'm convinced McEwen wasn't drunk, and I don't think he was under the influence of alcohol. But it was a great story, and it was played up in the tabloids that way, as drunk sergeant on death march and so forth.
All right. I just find, you know, it interesting, you know, that it was something that they would do, and certainly, you know, I know when I came into Marine Corps, a lot of guys had bottles of booze just about every OPSO and XO had, you know, they had a bottle of booze that they would, they'd close the door and have a drink when it was appropriate. Not like that, they didn't do it all the time, but certainly if there was a special occasion, somebody getting promoted or something like that, or a friend swung by, you know, the door would close and out would come the bottle. I find that interesting. But the bottom line is, you don't believe that alcohol, certainly as you said, he wasn't drunk. But you don't believe there was enough alcohol in him to affect his decision making ability.
Well, that's a closer call. So, but it doesn't seem to me a grown man who had a full meal at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, had slept for 2 or 3 hours, and had probably, you know, was no stranger to drinking in general. On what we know of the evidence, it doesn't seem to me that he would have still been affected at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night.
All right. We have about 6 minutes left. And so I don't want to start into the creek and then have to stop it. So can we save that for a week from today?
Sure.
Okay. I do have a couple emails. I do have a couple emails for you. Mac, like most of your other listeners, I don't know that much about Ribbon Creek, and but I have been a drill instructor, so I'm interested. I learned some stuff about it in DI school, but I don't think nearly enough as probably I should have in retrospect.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious about the level of corporal punishment in the platoon itself. It doesn't sound like they complained a whole lot that he was heavy-handed, and by and large, by Mr. Stevens' account, it seems like McEwen was a decent guy who was being tough on him, but they certainly had stepped out of line, and he was well within his rights. My question is, how often did recruits get taken to Ribbon Creek? Was it something frequent that happened? Was it infrequent? Does Mr. Stevens have any idea? So how often there, John?
The answer to that, as best I can tell you, is that I believe that taking recruits into the waters, all the marsh waters around Parris Island, was not that uncommon. I wouldn't say that that every platoon had happened, but I did speak with one former DI who was on the defense list of potential witnesses, never did testify, and he did testify, but he told me that he took 8 out of 8 platoons into the waters while he was there.
8 for 8.
And that it was nothing all that unusual. However, I never discovered any evidence that anyone had taken any recruits into Ribbon Creek.
Okay.
And Ribbon Creek would be a little different because it was a tidal creek, you know, with a pretty strong flow, and it also had a perilous bottom to it. There was a drop off, what they called the trout hole, that nobody seemed to know about. Certainly McEwen didn't, and that's where a lot of these recruits wound up in over their head.
All right, no idea. The Mac, I'm familiar with Parris Island, but I'm not familiar with where Ribbon Creek is. Could John kind of lay out where it is?
Well, if you're familiar with Parris Island, you know you come in on Malecon, and then you hit the Boulevard de France, and then if you take a right, go past the old third battalion, it's called Wake Boulevard. You go out about a mile to the rifle ranges. The rifle ranges are on your right, and the barracks are on your left, and Ribbon Creek flows behind the butts at the rifle range, parallel to them.
Okay, so
parallel to Wake Boulevard.
As I'm looking, there's Ballast Creek is on the barrack side. And Ribbon Creeks would be on the far side of the rifle range butts?
That's right.
Okay, on that back side.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, there it is. I see it on a map, Ribbon Creek. How big a body, how wide is it where they went in? How wide was the creek?
Well, I guess it depends on the tides, but if I had to guess, I've been down there many times. If I had to guess the distance, I would say 30 to 50 feet across.
30 to 50 feet across. Okay, I've got another email. Mac, great stuff. I'm really enjoying this conversation and learning a lot like everybody else. And I think it's a good thing that you're doing because I don't think most Marines know anything about Ribbon Creek other than what ultimately happened there and a lot of the lore that's grown up around it. My question is, since he didn't have a radio, what was the timeline between when they got in trouble in the creek and ultimately when somebody went back out there, and how long after the incident was McEwen arrested and tested? Were those tests, did they happen fairly quick? Was it a day or maybe two afterwards? What was the timeline associated with any type of rescue event or emergency personnel getting to the creek and also his detainment and ultimately testing? John?
The timeline is the best I can tell you. There was a hell of an outcry when the panic started in there. The recruits started grabbing on each other and screaming and yelling. So that a sentry picked that up immediately.
Oh, really? They heard him.
They heard him. They heard the racket down there. And so there were people down there within 10 minutes, 15 minutes after this happened. McEwen, when he came out of the waters, he lined them up to see who was there and who wasn't. And they had 8 missing, but 2 of them, it turned out, one was at chapel and one was in the sick bay or something like that. It was six bodies missing in the end. And so they were ordered to go back to the barracks, and they went back on foot. Some of them were, I guess, taken back by people that had come down in vehicles. And McEwen went back to the barracks. Huff was called in. And they discovered the bottle at that time, and McEwen was arrested. Now, I can't tell you whether this is a half an hour or 45 minutes, probably not more than an hour after all of this happened, probably less. And they took him down, and that's when he was tested. So he was, the test on him was probably not more than 2 hours, more closer to 1 hour after all this happened than 2 hours. Certainly not the next day or anything like that.
Well, I think that what the version I read, and it might have been written by the platoon guide, I think. His name is Gibbons, I think. Anyway, it said that they didn't realize how many people were gone until they got back to the barracks and counted off, and it just made it sound like a much longer flash to bang scenario than you described, that a sentry heard it.
Yeah, I don't think it was. They did do a lineup out there at the creekside, as I understand it, and then had them go back to the barracks and they did another lineup there. But I believe those happened, one right after another.
All right. John, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on. I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion this morning and learning about a subject I know very little of. So when we have you back on next week at the same time, we'll talk about the incident that night, the Marine Corps' response, the trial, and then the lesson learned, if you don't mind.
I don't mind, but I'm not going to be available next week at this time.
Okay. All right.
Well, I'd be happy to come back on again.
Maybe we can tape something later this week.
Okay.
How about if I'll give you a call and we'll set something up. But I want to thank you for doing this morning. And again, the book is entitled Court Martial at Parris Island, the Ribbon Creek Incident. You can find it on Amazon.com and written by a Marine veteran and currently retired, living in South Carolina after a career in the legal profession as a lawyer and a judge. So, John, first of all, pleasure to have you on, and thank you very much for doing this.
All right. Thank you, Mick.
All right. Very much. Thank you. That is John Stevens here on All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We're going to do the Marine Corps Heritage Hour. And you're going to hear from a couple legendary Marine figures. And that one of them is the 27th Commandant of the Marine Corps, Robert Barrow, Bob Barrow, born in 1922, passed away in 2008. A veteran of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And one of the things that made me want to do this was, I'll set it up when we come back. Remarks General Lynch made. And I thought, there's got to be a way that we can introduce those guys and hopefully their voices to those of us who never met them, but have certainly read about them. So that's what the Marine Corps Heritage Hour is all about. Again, we have an incredible heritage and so hopefully we'll be able to dig stuff up and find stuff that's extremely interesting. And that most of us have never heard. So we'll do that. The next hour coming up, the Marine Corps Heritage Hour. All right, we're going to take a quick break. All Marine Radio continues here on a Monday edition. Right after this.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Listen up, employers! Veterans can be a great asset to your company or organization. Veterans have gained skills in leadership, teamwork, and performance under pressure. Veterans have received the very best training in their fields and are never afraid to tackle a tough situation to accomplish the mission. If you are looking to hire a veteran, the Department of Labor can help you make it happen. You hire a veteran today, you won't be sorry.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
For America's wounded warriors, sometimes coming home can be a battle in itself. Every one of them needs our support to meet the challenges they face every day. The USO provides Americans a way to offer that support to our wounded warriors and their families. Join us. Visit USO.org to learn how you can make a difference in their lives by donating today. The USO.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.